Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, where it's going to be 82 degrees today. I hate to rub this in, but I have a guest who I think is not going to feel 82 degrees today. And I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Jerome Preisler. And the name of his book is Net Force, Moving Target. It is book four in this wonderful series, and I'm so happy that he's joining me today. But I want to announce that we might have an interruption. All of my listeners know Eugenia Lovett West is a favorite here on Joy on Paper. She's been an inspiration to many of the listeners because she just turned 100 years old. And 2 years ago, she wrote a book about cybercrime. She did the research, and she did a really wonderful mystery. So if she calls in, we're going to interrupt everything and put her on the line. But now I'm happy to welcome Jerome. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Patsy. We've scratched 20 degrees here, so I only need, 62 to get up to where you are?
Yeah.
And 6 inches of fresh snow.
Oh boy. Yeah. Well, you know, that's what happens, and it's you could have another one because you know I was born in March on March 28th, and it was one of the biggest snowstorms ever in northern Michigan. So you might have yet more coming your way.
You know, I'm going to blow a secret here. I'm going to disclose something. Every now and then, Patsy and I touch base via email between times I'm on the show, and she'll always tell me about the manatee and the dolphin in her neck of the woods, and I'm looking at half-starved squirrels trying to get in for warmth. So our little banter goes on even off the air.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm just rubbing it in a little bit. We're so happy because we were freezing here. It went down to 44 degrees a few weeks ago, and I was frozen.
Oh, wow. Awful.
And so I was thinking of you.
Oh. If I saw 44, I'd be running out in my bathing suit.
Well, I'm so happy that you're here today to talk about new book. And, you know, one thing, I'm going to stop right now. I just want to make sure, am I pronouncing your name correctly? You know, we've known each other quite a while. I'm not sure because recently I've had people with pronouncing their names differently than I expect. So how do you pronounce your last name?
Preisler.
So Jerome Preisler.
Yeah, so you've got it.
You've got a wonderful book. It was out on Tuesday. I wanted to wait 2 days to have you so I could have you for a longer time because I know whenever you have a pub day, you're always busy with lots of interviews. It's worth the wait because I'm going to have you here for the entire hour to talk about the book. For me, it was so exciting to get the book, and I love getting it in advance. Tell us about this latest techno thriller out at the right time.
Yeah, you know, to be honest, I kind of resist that label because I think that I just really consider it a thriller. And as you know, you've read all the books, and you know, I think that it's really kind of a cross genre series, and that really just reflects what I like to read. You know, I read all sorts of books, and I think all of it just kind of goes into the blender. So I think Net Force as a whole, and maybe even this book more than any of the others, really kind of plays with boundaries of different genres. I obviously, you know there are certain foundations or underpinnings that I know are really part of being a series that was co-created by Tom Clancy, and I know what marks I have to hit, and I well understand the framework of that. I think that in this book, again, it really moves into some different and interesting areas that I didn't expect. There was one author who was kind enough to compare it a little bit to Blade Runner, which I thought was interesting because I hadn't thought of it. But then I thought, yeah, actually, it's kind of neat because there are elements of that in there. The Da Vinci Code. And I thought, wow, I hadn't thought of that one either. But yeah, there's a little bit of that in there. So Moving Target is a lot of things.
And mostly it's just an absolutely fun read, very exciting. Lots of action. And, of course, it starts off in, well, one of our favorite cities, Paris. So there's so much that you've worked with there. What do you want to tell us about the setting for this? Because you really put a new look on Paris for many people.
Well, we start out with, really the focus in this book is on my character, Khali Alcazar. And throughout the series, I've been really hinting at a backstory for Khali. I present her in book one, Dark Web, as almost a lone wolf, gray hat hacker, someone who does things according to her own set of moral codes and principles. But even in that book, I knew that there were bigger things in store for her, and I hinted at Khali being part of something that was a lot more than what amounts to her own code. And in this book, that really comes to fruition. So Khali's closest friend has disappeared in Paris, and we open the story with Khali in Paris. She disappears at the end of the previous book, Threat Point. This picks up days later. She's in Paris, and she's looking for her best friend, who she believes to be hiding in what's known as the catacombs beneath Paris. And I say what's known as because catacombs really connote, you know, a burial and tomb, but only a small section of the tunnels beneath Paris are catacombs. I believe it's something like 1.4 miles or thereabouts, and there are 200 miles of tunnels beneath the streets of Paris. Many people don't know that. The 1-point-something miles that are the catacombs are open to the public, and there are guided tours, and they've been open, I believe, since around the time of Napoleon, who created them as a tourist attraction after seeing something similar in Rome. But here we're dealing with the rest of it. What is the rest of that 200 miles look like? And Khali knows her friend is somewhere down there. She's hunting for him at the same time as there are people who are hunting for her, as well as her friend. And those people are bio in hand. They're cherry-picked from mercenary groups like the Wagner Group and others. They enter the catacombs looking for her. They find a way, without giving away too much, they find a way to track her and follow her to her friend. So it's a real cat-mouse game, and I think it's what was really interesting is I could weave together what's known about these tunnels and actual places and actual sites that people have visited with some flight suspense. That's where we are.
Yeah, and talk about atmospheric writing. You really take us down there to the point that I'm now a little bit claustrophobic. Well, I did go down and you know, have the tour years ago. Today, I couldn't do it. And in the book, I was sometimes like gasping for air. Oh, and it's so exciting. There are points in this book where it is so exciting. We're just on a race here, and it gets so exciting. All the characters that are, you know, that you bring out, well, they're all so interesting. But Khali is the one that, you know, I relate to. I really enjoy reading about her. I tell you, around page 300, there is a epic fight scene. It has to be one of the best choreographed fight scenes. And I think you'll know the one. It's I don't want to say who's fighting who, but it's around.
Is it from the water?
I tell you, it is so. It's beautifully choreographed. I mean, you have to. How did you work it all out? Did you sort of get up out of your chair and say, "I'm moving here, I'm moving here, I'm moving there"?
You know, it's funny. I really, in the last few years, I've gotten into choreographing these scenes. You know, I really started watching, you know, some of these movies. Like, became a huge fan of the John Wick movies, and was blown away by the way they do it. And the way they've broken new ground. They've really, essentially what, you know, Keanu Reeves and company did when they started doing these Wick movies was they looked at, you know, the action genre, and they said, well, you know, if it's going to be action, let's just take action to the max. That's what they did. They just broke all the rules. I think that really influenced me. So beginning with really Attack Protocol, the second book in the series, I started really thinking about choreographing action scenes and just playing them out in my mind. And, you know, we often look at them, we think of the action as kind of in a summary fashion. This happened, that happened. But within it, if you break it down in terms of millisecond to millisecond, moment to moment, what's going on? What's happening in this person's head? What's happening in that person's head? How does one bounce off the other? What is not only how do they react to each other, but what's happening in the space that they're in? You know, I think if I have the right scene in mind, there's a lot going on, and it's just a matter of sort of, at that point, you know, thinking it through, putting yourself in that space as much as you can. I will say that throughout this book, I rarely knew how she was going to get out of trouble until she ultimately figured it out for me. I was going by the seat of my pants for a lot of it.
Well, luckily,
and I think that's great. I think that shows.
It is. And luckily, she carries a very interesting weapon, a Japanese weapon. Do you happen to have one?
I don't actually own one, no, but I have researched Japanese martial arts and Japanese weaponry. And I have, throughout my life, played around with some.
Yeah, the Manriki, which is really nice. When I was doing kickboxing, my instructor had one. It is a chain. The police actually use them in Japan to capture criminals. They wrap it around their leg to stop them.
Yeah, there are some of these people that are so incredibly skilled at using that chain that it's incredible to watch them. Yeah. And you know, the thing is that it takes so long, obviously, to master something like that. I'm sure that some of these people go through tremendous pain before they can actually inflict pain on the bad guys or the good guys.
Or gals, because there are some...
Or gals.
Oh, let's not leave the women out of this one. Boy, oh boy.
Well, we're speaking guys.
I know. yes, but you are really good at writing about bad women. I mean, there's some evil going afoot there.
Yeah, I like writing female characters. And it's really interesting because, you know, years ago, I wrote a series of what they call in the trade cozies, which are some kind of comedic mysteries, as I'm sure you know. And back then, and even I think to this day, there was really a sense in the publishing industry that a male writer couldn't write a cozy that was written, in many instances, they're written first, most instances, they're first-person mysteries, and are written from a woman's perspective. Usually the lead character is female. I wrote one of these under a pseudonym, actually two series under a pseudonym. I never saw, I mean, you know, people are people, and hopefully we all know members of the opposite sex, and I never saw a problem with it. But so for me, it's really easy to kind of write from, and interesting to write from a female point of view, and also I just like badass women.
Boy, oh boy. You've got some of the best ones. Absolutely. For me, it's so thrilling when I read these, and I get so excited. And with this scene, and there are a couple other scenes where it's like, you know, I see it as a movie in my head, but when I get to the scene, I actually, this scene, because it was so intense, I mean, really intense, and it kept going, and I, at one point, I'm closing my eyes, like, I don't want to see it, then I have to open my eyes, I'm saying, I'm reading a book, for goodness sakes. That's how intense it was.
You know, one thing about my actual writing of this story, I wrote it, actually, my father had just passed away, or passed away just after I started writing the book. That coincided with the big Omicron wave, and in fact, when he was hospitalized in his last days, the visiting protocols were changing by the day. And I was alone with him in his final hours, and they were pretty difficult. I was in New York. I came back to Maine, and it was December, middle of the winter, so here we were all... And, you know, I was kind of in double or triple isolation and dealing with all of this and knowing I had a book to write. So I think that Collie's journey through those catacombs or tunnels beneath Paris, I don't want to get too heavy about it, but for me, they were kind of metaphor. And, you know, I use, I know you picked up, I have all these little references to T.S. Eliot in the book, and some of them are playful and some of them are kind of really bouncing off his poem, The Wasteland. And that, you know, anyone who's read that, and to me it's one of the greatest poems of the 20th century, that really is kind of describes the fractured nature of what I was going through and what I think the world was and is going through. Again, I don't want to get too heavy-handed, but all of these things really seeped into me. And I think that when writing about Kali, there was that sense, what propelling her through all of this was friendship, the love of a friend. That's really what was driving her, and that was what was going to get her through. And I think if going through the story, again, I don't want to give too much away, but she runs into these people who pop up in this World Beneath the World, and there were two. I'll just name them. I'm not going to say much about them, but one is Jacques and one is Gilles, Jack and Jill, and that's not their real names, presumably, but those are the names that they give her. And I didn't expect those two to be in the story. I didn't know anything about them at first. And as you know, they became major characters. There was there's a character called Etienne who she meets and Kali runs into him. And he really needs help. He's lost and she finds him. Yeah. And again, I'm not going to give more away. You know, all of that, the kind of people pulling together in these dark circumstances, the need for friendship to get through, that was kind of a running theme. And whether it was conscious or not, I don't know, but it was certainly a running theme that I realized evolved as the book went on.
I was going to mention Etienne because I was so happy when you introduced him. It was sort of, you know, we're in the tunnel, we're sort of gasping for air, and then we meet him, and it was so refreshing, and I right away recognized, oh, this is a great character. Now, Jerome, I have to take a commercial break. We're going to come back, we're going to talk more about this book, and perhaps you'll explain a little bit about maybe The White Rose. I'll be right back with Jerome Preisler, and we're going to be talking about NetForce, Moving Target.